I'm sure you've learned by now, friends can be mean. As a matter of fact, well-meaning friends can be downright mean. I was interested in this, so I looked up the word mean in the dictionary and found out that it has a number of different definitions. The adjective means unaccommodating, offensive, nasty, malicious. You ever had that experience? You ever had a friend that was just downright mean to you? I guess in order to answer that in the affirmative, you need to start what? In elementary school, where they are mean to each other, goes through junior high, high school, and into our adult life. Well, as you probably can figure out by now, that's exactly what happened to Job. You know the story. Job was being used by the Lord to prove to Satan that he would not deny him, and Satan inflicted him a number of different ways. He lost his family, he lost his wealth, he lost his health, he lost the support of his wife, and then his three best friends show up. Now, as you've heard me say in this series, those three friends have each speak, and that's what we call round one. At the end of that, they each speak again. That's round two. And then they start a third round, only this time only two of them speak instead of all three. And they basically are all saying the same thing, namely, Job, you are suffering because you are sinning. But they intensify that message. They get more and more adamant about it. As a matter of fact, we are now tonight going to enter the second round and look at the beginning of the second round in Job chapter 15. And as we do, we're going to see Eliphaz tell Job exactly what he thinks of him, and I'm calling that downright mean. One author says that in this round there's greater hostility. Another one says they become more vicious. Another one says they become more condemning. So my point being that they started out blunt and a little rude, and it got worse. So the word I'm using at this stage is they were mean. So turn with me to Job chapter 15, and let's see just how mean he was. In Job's next speech, he basically does two things. The first thing he does is he rebukes Job. And then he reminds Job all over again of that same basic premise that you are suffering because of sin. So I want us to look first of all at his rebuke. I'm going to tell you up front what he says, and then we're going to look at it verse by verse. He says to Job, you are ignorant, you are irreverent, you are ignoring wisdom, and you're claiming you're innocent, but you're not. Now, given the situation, I'm calling that really mean stuff. Look at verse 1. He says to him, should a wise man answer with empty knowledge and fill himself with the east wind? Now, prior to this, Job has claimed that he had a little wisdom. Remember, he said, you don't have all the wisdom. When you die, is all the wisdom in the world going to die with you? And he's claiming he has some wisdom. So what Eliphaz is saying at this point is he's asking him if a wise man would answer like he has answered with empty knowledge. In other words, he's saying, you're just talking. It's just mere talk. It's like the east wind. The east wind in Palestine was destructive. So what you're saying is not constructive, Job. It's actually destructive to the whole conversation. In other words, he's saying, you are not wise at all. Job, you're ignorant. Blunt, but that's what he says. Look at verse 3. Should he reason with unprofitable talk or by speeches with which he can do no good? In other words, can unprofitable talk do any good? Your talk is ignorant, Job. You don't know what you're talking about. It's empty knowledge, verse 2. it's full of hot air. And now he says it's unprofitable. So the point of these verses is you don't know anything. You're ignorant. The second thing he says is you're irreverent. Look at verse 4. Yes, you cast off fear and retain power before God. And what he's really saying here is you don't fear God. You're irreverent. Prior to this, the discussion had centered around whether or not Job sinned in the past. That question now replaces that with an emphasis on Job sinning now. He started out saying, you're suffering because of sin you committed in the past. Now he's saying, no. You're now sinning. You don't fear God and you're irreverent. Verse 5, for your iniquity teaches your mouth and you choose the tongue of crafty. He's emphasizing going a step further, not only accusing Job of irreverence toward God, but iniquity in what he says about God. So the first charge is you're ignorant. Second charge is you're irreverent. The third charge is you're ignoring wisdom. Look at verse 7. Are you the first man who was born? Or were you made before the hills? With a little sarcasm, he thinks, are you older than the wise men we have quoted? You're ignoring that wisdom of the ages we talked about. Verse 8, have you heard the counsel of God? Do you limit wisdom to yourself? What he's saying is he's imagining that God has an advisory council, like the president has an advisory council. And he's saying, are you a member of the advisory council of God? I mean, you claiming all this wisdom, are you as smart as you think you are? He says in verse 9, do you know that we do not know? What do you understand that is not in us? He moves from knowing more than anyone to knowing the counsel of God to knowing what his friends know. He says in both verse 10, both the gray-headed and the aged are among us, much older than your fathers. He's saying some of us are older than your father. By the way, that's interesting. They're now pulling rank. This gray hair we got proves that we got more wisdom than you do. Matter of fact, some of us are older than, were born even before your father. So you're not as smart as you think you are. You lack wisdom. But the real charge starts in verse 12. You are not innocent. And this is the whole thesis of all three friends. Why does your heart carry you away, and what do your eyes wink at that you turn your spirit against God and let such words go out of your mouth? Why do you let your emotions carry you away, Job? Putting all the phrases together, the point he's making is why let your emotions and pride control you to the point that you speak against God? Verse 14, what is man that he should be pure? And he who was born of woman that he should be righteous? Now remember, Job is claiming he didn't do anything to deserve all this. That's his whole point. And he's claiming innocence. In response, Eliphaz asks, what man born of woman is really pure? You're claiming to be innocent. Why, everybody born of woman is a sinner. So he says in verse 15, if God put no trust in his saints, by the way, this is a problem. Most commentaries think the word saints here is a reference to angels. So if that's the case, he is saying, if God put no trust in angels and the heavens are not pure in his sight, how much less, man who is abominable and filthy, who drinks iniquity like water. So what he's saying, if God didn't trust angels or consider heaven pure, how can filthy, abominable man who drinks iniquity like water be righteous? I think what he's probably, it's a hypothetical kind of a situation. Heavens are unclean, according to this statement, as compared to God. So he's saying, if that's the case, how could you possibly claim to be innocent and righteous? So, He's simply attacking Job. And I'm calling that, given the circumstances, mean stuff. Can you imagine visiting somebody in the ICU ward and saying to them, you know, you're here because you're a sinner. And you're really ignorant, irreverent, you ignore wisdom, and you're not at all innocent. Would you call that being mean? I call that being mean. Well, it gets worse. Now, Eliphaz is going to really pound the pulpit on the fact that the wicked suffer. You are suffering, therefore, you're wicked. And so what he does, beginning in chapter 15, verse 17, he says, I will tell you, hear me. What I have seen, I will declare. So he says, in essence, Job, listen to me. And I'm going to tell you what I have declared. Do you remember his first speech? He argued from his experience. He kept saying, what I have heard, what I have seen. Well, he's back to playing that game. So let me just tell you from observation what I know, because you're ignorant, you don't know anything. Then he says, wise men, verse 18, have told, not hidden anything received from their fathers, to whom alone the land was given, no alien passing among them. So he moves from his own observation in verse 17 to the wisdom of the past. And if you'll recall, prior to this, those are the arguments that have been used. I called it the knowledge from the past, I call tradition. So the argument is, from our own experience and our observation, plus the wisdom of the ages, we know wicked men suffer. And that's stated in verse 20. The wicked men wither with pain all his days, and the number of years is hidden from the oppressors. In other words, he's saying, what I have observed and what I know from the past wise men, wicked people are the ones who suffer. That's the sum of verses 17 through 20. What he does next is really interesting. He then starts at verse 20, and he gives 17 troubles that befall a sinner. Now keep in mind, I'm outlining his discourse, these are subpoints. I've never had a message that had 17 subpoints. Matter of fact, I take that back. I did do that recently. You remember? I read the book, The 17 Steps to Salvation. Those were subpoints. I have done that. I'd forgotten that until just standing here right this minute. All right, I'm going to run through these very quickly because the point is the same. Job, you are a sinner. And the way we know that is wicked people suffer, and you are suffering. So therefore, you must be wicked. So he first says, the wicked men suffer all of his life. That's verse 20, the first part of verse 20. Then he says, the wicked men die earlier than the godly. That's the latter part of verse 20. And the number of years is hidden from the oppressor. In other words, you don't know when you're going to die, and you're going to cut off before your time. Number three, the wicked hears dreadful sounds. That's the first part of verse 21. Dreadful sounds are heard in his ears. Job certainly heard all kinds of terrifying news. It's probably a reference to that. Number four, wicked men suffer destruction even in prosperity. That's the latter part of verse 21. In prosperity, the destroyer comes upon him. Number five, the wicked man has no confidence that he will return safely from impending danger. That's the first part of verse 22. He does not believe that he will return from darkness. And darkness here is probably a reference to danger. Number six, the wicked feel that he is a haunted person. That's the latter part of verse 22. For a sword is waiting for him. Number seven, the wicked man is anxious about his basic needs. That's verse 22. He wanders about for bread, saying, where is it? He knows that a day of darkness is ready at his hand. Number 8, the wicked man shall experience trouble and anguish. He says that in verses 24 to 26. Trouble and anguish make him afraid. They overpower him like a king ready for battle. For he stretches out his hand against God and acts defiantly against the Almighty, running stubbornly against him with his strong, embossed shield. The wicked man suffers because he is defiant against God. Number 9, the wicked end up alone. Verse 27, though he has covered his face with his fatness and made his waist heavy with fat, he dwells in isolated cities. He's alone. In houses no one inhabits. He's alone. Which are destined to become ruin. He is alone. The expression, he covers his face with fatness and makes his waist heavy with fat, describes a life of luxury, gluttony. But instead of living in affluence in a splendid city, he will be compelled to take up his abode in a place that has been deserted and abandoned. The point being, he's wicked, so he's going to be alone. Number 10, the wicked shall lose his wealth. Verse 29, he will not be rich, nor will his wealth continue, nor his possessions overspread the earth. Now, is that a slap in Job's face or what? Job lost his wealth, and Eliphaz is taking a poke at him. Number 11, the wicked shall not escape from calamity, here called darkness. He will not depart from darkness. The flame will dry out his branches, and by the breath of his mouth he will go away. Number 12, the wicked who trust in futile things end up in deception and futility. Verse 31, let him who trusts in futile things, deceiving himself for futility, will be his reward. Number 13, the wicked will suffer prematurely. Verse 32, it will be accomplished before his time. Number 14, the wicked's wealth will fail. Verse 33, he will shake off the unripe grapes like a vine and cast off his blossom like an olive tree. Number 15, the wicked man will experience barrenness, for the company of the hypocrite will be barren. Number 16, the wicked man who accepts bribes will have his tent burned. Verse 34, the second part of verse 34, the fire will consume the tent of bribery. And finally, in 17, the wicked will form and execute plans of evil. Verse 35, they conceive trouble and bring forth futility. Their wound prepares deceit. Now, simple summary. Wicked people suffer. All kinds. Now, there's some overlap in these 17 things, but the basic idea in all 17 statements is that the wicked people suffer. Now, that's his speech. Before we look at Job's answer, I want to pause here and make some observations. What Eliphaz is saying is, Job, you are ignorant, irreverent, ignoring wisdom. You're not as innocent as you think you are, and I want to remind you that from my own experience and looking at people in the past, we know that wicked people suffer. You are suffering, therefore you must be wicked. Now that sums up that whole chapter. Now what can we learn from that? All right. I think it's interesting that they are using their observation about life in general. They are using tradition to accuse Job of sinning. Now, before you accuse somebody of sinning, what should you have?
Evidence.
A tradition? Should you have your own experience about life in general, such as wicked people suffer, you're suffering, therefore you're wicked?
Nope.
Logic? What do you need before you accuse somebody of sinning? What does the scripture say you need? Two or three witnesses. So if we don't learn anything else about this, we should learn to be careful before we judge people, that we don't judge them based on observation of life in general, tradition, or our personal opinion, but you've got to have facts first. And they didn't. They had no facts. The second thing I would say is this. This is harsh stuff. I'm calling it mean-spirited. But this is harsh. So I think we need to learn from this that we need to be gentle. That if you're going to correct somebody, and there is a place for that, at least be gentle about it. As a matter of fact, Paul says in 2 Timothy, the servant of the Lord must not strive, but must be gentle, apt to teach. And maybe if you do it in the right spirit, who knows, they might repent, he says in 2 Timothy chapter 2. So I think one of the things we can learn by contrast is that we need to be gentle. One author says that Eliphaz lambasted this guy. Another says there was no tenderness in him at all. That somebody has said, in the eyes of these spiritual doctors, Job is like a patient who has lung cancer because he smokes too much. And now they say, just look at this old fool. In spite of all the radiation, surgery, and chemotherapy, he still puffs away like a human smokestack. In such a case, conclude the doctor, it seems useless to waste even an ounce of pity. The fact that they themselves might have come attached to a worse disease, cancer of the heart, brought on by failure of love, is conveniently overlooked in their medical textbook. End of quote. I thought that was extremely well put. So, they were totally lacking in mercy. So the thing we need to learn is be gentle. That doesn't mean you shouldn't speak the truth. It doesn't mean that you shouldn't correct the person. It just means be gentle in the process. The servant of the Lord must not strive, but be gentle. All right. At this point, Job answers Eliphaz. And what he does is a number of different things. The first thing he does, in essence, is he says, I am disgusted with my friends. Look at chapter 16, verse 1. Then Job answered and said, I have heard many such things. Miserable comforters are you all. He's not just speaking to Eliphaz, he's speaking to all three, and he's saying, you know what? You are a miserable excuse for a comforter. He said, you've not said anything new. You haven't said anything I didn't already know. But the real issue is, you're just a miserable comforter. You came to console him, and you haven't done it. And now all you've done is irritate me and deepen my distress. So instead of coming and giving them comfort, they gave him condemnation. And he said, you are a miserable comforter. So he gave it right back to him. Kind of like that in this situation. That's a good thing. Look at verse 3. Shall words of wind have an end? Or what provokes you that you answer? In other words, there's no need of words of wind, which are words devoid of thought. He charges them with being windbags. What have I said that makes you say such unkind and severe and harsh and mean things? So he first talks about their method. They are miserable counselors, miserable comforters. Now he's going to contrast that with what he would do. Look at verse 4. I also could speak as you do. If your soul were in my soul's place, I could heap up words against you and shake my head at you. That's what I could do. I could do that. Shaking my head is almost a universal expression of contempt. That's what he means. I could be contemptuous towards you. I could. But look at verse 5. But I would. Notice he says in verse 4, I could. And he says in verse 5, I would strengthen you with my words, and comfort of my lips would revive your grief. He says, all you've done is condemn me. If the roles were reversed, I wouldn't do that to you. I could be as mean as you are, but I'm not. I would strengthen you. I would encourage you. I would comfort you. I would relieve your grief, not add to it. So the first thing he does is he says, in essence, I am totally disgusted with you so far. He shot right back at him. Now, Job is perplexed about what's happening to him. He doesn't understand what we've been told in chapter 1. So throughout this discourse with his friends, he expresses his distress. So he then, in the next little subsection of his speech, he says just that. I am being distressed, and it's all coming from God. Now he's going to express his feelings again, which he's done several times before. So he says in verse 6, my suffering is continuing. Though I speak, my grief is not relieved. And if I remain silent, how am I eased? In other words, whether I speak or remain silent, the suffering continues. Neither silence, nor argument, nor entreaty avails me before God or man. The point is, the suffering is continuing. Then he says, and he's talking about his distress, God has exhausted me. Look at verse 7. But now he has worn me out. Notice verse 7. He is a capital H. That's a reference to God. He has worn me out. Then he says, you. And that's a capital U. At that point, right in the middle of the verse, he addresses God. You have made desolate all my company. God has worn him out. God has exhausted him. And he tells God he has destroyed his household. Me and my company, my household. Then he says God has compressed him with affliction. In verse 8, you have shriveled me up. And is a witness against me. My leanness rise up against me and bears witness to my face. In other words, God has compressed him with all of this suffering. God has delivered him to his enemies. Verse 9, he tears me in his wrath and he hates me. He gathers with me his teeth. My adversary sharpens his gaze against me. You know, I think if we met somebody that talked like this, we'd be horrified. Think, man, this is an atheist, an agnostic, or somebody that's anti-religious. This is a real experience, and Christians go through this. Christians can go through this kind of feeling God has abandoned them. On the cross, Jesus said, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? And he's quoting Psalm 22, which is the experience of David. If you think Christians can't experience this, read the Psalms. It's the same thing that's going on here. God has delivered me to my enemies. He tears me in his wrath. He hates me. This is poetry. I explained that when we started the book. This is the way he feels. Poetry expresses emotion. He says in verse 10, they grip at me with their mouth, the great question of the morning. They strike me reproachfully on the cheek and gather together against me. They, in this case, are his friends, and they've gathered together in a conspiracy and to open their mouth and devour him like a wild beast. And again, he's simply saying, God has delivered me to my enemies, and guess who my enemies are? It's you guys, my friends. Verse 11. God has delivered me to the ungodly and turned me over to the hands of the wicked. He's calling. This is really funny, you know. I'm suffering at the hands of my enemies. You know what? God has delivered me to ungodly and wicked people. He is clearly referring to his friends. So they are saying he's a sinner and he's just giving it right back to them. I wouldn't treat you this way. But I'm going to tell you something. That's the way you're treating me, and it's wrong. So he's giving it back to them. But he's saying that God is the one that allowed this. So he says in verse 12, I was at ease. You know, I wasn't sick. I wasn't distressed. But he, notice capital H, he has shattered me. He, capital H, has also taken me by the neck and shaken me to pieces. Next verse. He set me up for his target. His archers surround me. They pierce my heart when they don't have pity. They pour out my gall on the ground. So he envisions God being an archer shooting arrows at him, and that's the way he feels. I'm just shot through. So he says in verse 14, he breaks me with the wound upon wound. He runs at me like a warrior. So God has broken him with one wound after another. So he says, I have grieved. I have sewn sackcloth over my skin and lay my head in the dust. My face is flushed from weeping, and my eyelids is the shadow of death. In his grief, he wept. Tears made his face red. He felt that he was about to die. So, all he's doing in this section is he is describing his distress. And it's coming in part from his friends, but ultimately God's the one that's allowing it. But he concludes this section by saying, but I'm innocent. Although no violence is in my hand and my prayer is pure, I'm telling you guys, I have not sinned. I did not do anything to deserve this suffering. I am innocent. I am suffering greatly. It's continuing to this moment, but I am innocent, and my prayer is pure. All right. He moves from his distress to giving his desire. I'm going to tell you what I want. Because I'm innocent, I'm going to tell you what I want. I want an advocate. I want somebody to stand up for me. You ever felt like that, by the way? You ever been so abused, knocked around? People coming at you, I'd like a good attorney. Well, that's basically what he says. Look at verse 18. O earth, do not cover my blood and let my cry have no resting place. In other words, earth, stand up for me. Don't soak up my blood like you soaked up Abel's blood. He's pleading with the earth that the injuries not destroy him so that he sheds blood. Then he turns his attention from earth to heaven. He says in verse 19, surely even now my witness is in heaven and my evidence is on high. So what he desires is a witness in heaven. That is, he wants an advocate in heaven. He wants a lawyer to plead his case. He's not asking for a mediator. He's asking for an advocate. A mediator tries to get two sides together. An advocate is a lawyer who pleads his case. So what he's saying in verse 19 is, that's what I want. I want an advocate in heaven to get God's attention and plead my case that I'm innocent, and that's all this suffering isn't a result of my sin. Then, having spoken about the earth and heaven, he speaks about his friends. Look at verse 20. My friends scorn me. My eyes pour out tears to God. I mean, he just referred a minute ago to weeping. I would imagine that the physical pain, boils from head to toe, were enough to make him cry. Enough to make a grown man cry. Isn't that the expression? But how about all the psychological suffering he's going through? I mean, would that not make you cry? So what I want you to notice, he's talked about crying before. What I want you to notice in this case is he says, I pour out my tears to God. Though he feels God has dealt with him fairly, he's still talking to the Lord. And he's crying and he's shedding tears. The crying in this case is literal. So he complains that his friends have mocked him. They scorn him, according to verse 20, and he weeps before God. So he says, oh, that one might plead for a man with God. A man pleads for his neighbor. And this is what I mentioned a minute ago. He wants an advocate. He wants somebody to plead his case. He says in verse 22, for when a few years are finished, I shall go my way of no return. He said, I need a friend now because in a few short years, I'm going to die. My spirit is broken. My days are extinguished. The grave is ready for me. He's depressed. His days are all but gone. He's ready to die. Are not mockers with me? And does not my eyes dwell on their provocation? Instead of defending him before the Lord, his friends, so-called, are mocking him, and his eyes are fixed on their provocation. And that's not a mere glance. He says, I'm looking at you, and I'm giving you a long, hard study, and that's what I see. So, he says, verse 17, verse 3, now, put down a pledge for me with yourself, capital Y. He, all of a sudden, he turns to God again. And he says, who is he who is will shake hands with me? He's asking God to put down a pledge and seal the deal with a handshake. The purpose of this pledge is, in this verse, is rather obscure, but apparently in ancient times, that in a court, that was a bond that guaranteed the litigant would be treated fairly and honestly. So he's saying, I want an advocate, and I want the Lord to give me a pledge. He's going to deal with me, and let's shake on it. I want him to deal with me fairly, and let's shake on it. There used to be a time when that was true in this country. No more. Now you have to have a lawyer for any kind of an agreement. But there was a day when you could shake on it. Verse 4, for you have hidden, notice the capital Y, he's talking to God, you have hidden their heart from understanding, therefore you will not exalt them. The reason for this request is that God has hidden the truth of his innocence from the understanding of his professed friends. He says they don't get it. So, chapter 17, verse 5. They speak flattery to his friend, even the eyes of his children will fail. Instead of defending him, his friends have been traitors. Such faithless, fickle friends mean that instead of a reward, judgment's going to come on them and their children. Boy, Job is giving it right back to them. So in chapter 16, verse 18, through chapter 17, verse 6, Job pleads that somebody, the earth, the heavens, his friend, would plead his case before God. And then he does something else. This is the last thing he does. He's in his despair. He is facing death. This is not new. He's done this before. He's contemplating death. He's not suicidal. He just thinks that all this suffering is going to kill him and that that would be a welcome relief. So he says in chapter 17, verse 6, but he has made me a byword of the people, and I've become one of those faces men spit. And the idea is spit at. In other words, God has made him a reproach, a byword, which means people scorn at him. People spit in his face. You can just imagine. Now, the idea is he's a sinner because he's sinning, right? And that's just not the opinion of his three friends. That was probably the opinion of the whole community. So he's sitting there in this ash pile in the garbage dump, and parents walk by and say to their kids, see him? You don't want to end up like that. And he sinned. You see that? So he becomes the byword, to use the expression in verse 6, which means he is the object of reproach, ridicule, and scorn. They're making fun of him. So he says, verse 7, My eyes have grown dim because of sorrow, and all the members are like shadows. I'm exhausted, and I've been mistreated. Upright men are astonished at this, and the innocent stir himself up against the hypocrite. Upright men would be appalled at the treatment he's been given. That's sort of the idea. Yet the righteous hold to his way, and he who has clean hands will be stronger and stronger. You need to put a star by that verse. What's he claiming? I'm innocent, and I'm going to get stronger and stronger. I'm not going to give in to you because you're not right. You're a sinner like everybody else, and you're a miserable counselor and comforter. So there, the righteous will hold to his way. He who has clean hands will be stronger and stronger. I'm telling you, I'm innocent, and I'm going to get stronger. So, but please come back again, all of you, for I shall not, or maybe I cannot, find one wise man among you. All right, come on, come back at me. But I'm going to tell you, I hadn't found a wise man among the three of you. So he's standing up to them. I love it. Verse 11, my days are past, my purposes are broken off, even the thoughts of my heart. In other words, he's about to die. His plans have failed. His desires are unfulfilled. He gets down to the end of life and he says, I'm not going to finish it. I'm done. I'm about to die. So, he says in verse 12, they change the night into day. The light is near, they say, in the face of darkness. Now, this is a little tricky because they, in this context, is a reference to his thoughts, which he mentioned in this verse. His thoughts change his day to night. These purposes and thoughts are so very gloomy, they change day into night. So he says, if I wait for the grave as my house, if I make my bed in the darkness, if I say to corruption, you are my father, and to the worm, you are my mother and my sister, where then is hope? So using figures of speech, he exclaims, I've made up my mind that I'm going to die. Where is my hope? There is nothing left but the grave with its darkness, its corruption, and its worms. One last statement, the middle of verse 15 through verse 16. As for my hope, who can see it? Will they go down to the gate of Sheol, that is the grave? Shall we here rest together in the dust? He adds three more questions, asking where is his hope? Will they, that is his hopes, not go to the grave of death? Shall he and his hopes die together? All the expectations that I've cherished all my life and all the happiness will descend there with me. It'll all be destroyed. So, Job finishes his speech with the idea that I'm about to die and I'm anticipating that. Earlier in the book, he said, and that would be a relief. All right, we've gone through a lot of verses. But it's really pretty simple what's going on here. If you summarize it all, it would be something like this. In response to all three of his friends, Job tells them how disgusted he is with them, how distressed he is with his suffering, how he has a desire for an advocate in heaven, and yet he is despair of life itself, and he thinks he's going to die. So let me put this in perspective for us. I entitled this, When Friends Can Be Mean. So let me ask, when a friend is so mean as to rebuke you for being ignorant, irreverent, ignoring wisdom, and not being innocent, what do you do? You ever had that happen? Has one of your friends ever told you, you're not as smart as you think you are? Maybe the last time that happened is when you were a teenager and your parents told you that. You ever been told that? When it wasn't true? And that's the kicker. It wasn't true. What do you do? Well, this is where I think we can gain a great lesson. Here's what Job did. You ready? He said, "Gentlemen, you are miserable comforters. And even though you think you know something, you know nothing. I'm about to die, but I'm going to cry out to the Lord with all of my tears." Now, let me break that down in 1, 2, 3 simple observations. Here's what I think you should do. If you have a mean friend attacking you, 1, recognize that friends can be mean. If you aren't prepared for that, it's going to hurt worse. So just recognize friends can be mean. Job's friends were, and he told them that they were. "You are miserable comforters, you all." Chapter 16, verse 2. Evidently, there are people walking around who are thin-skinned and they get their feelings hurt. Ever met anybody like that? You just have to be pastor of a church to appreciate that. They're in every church. They get their feelings hurt. I'm amazed at what offends people or hurts their feelings. It just never ceases to surprise me. Well, let me tell you how you can make it through life a little better. People are mean. Let me translate. Friends are mean. Let me translate. Even friends close to you can be mean. So when it happens, don't let it trip you up or destroy you. That's life. That's what happens. Expect it. And if you understand that, it'll make life a little easier. I'm going to make a second observation. As we were going through these passages, I pointed it out that twice Job talks about crying. So here's my suggestion. Recognize that friends can be mean, and when they hurt you, cry. I mean, literally. Now, I suspect that women will be more receptive to that than men. Men don't cry, right? Job did. We should cry. Cry's healthy. Cry's a good thing. He said in chapter 16, verse 16, "My face is flushed from weeping, and my eyelids is the shadow of death." One author said this. I thought it was very interesting. "Because God's feelings toward us are so strongly emotional." God's feelings are emotional. He respects strong emotions in human beings. I sometimes think we get the idea God's a robot, you know, like a computer. God is a being. The Bible is very clear about that. He's full of wrath sometimes. He gets angry. He's also full of compassion. God has emotion. So, this author points out, if God has emotion, he expects it from us. So, you need to learn to cry. When it hurts and when it's appropriate, go have a good cry. You'll feel better. A Bible teacher I greatly respect said, "Many of God's dearest servants have been moved to weeping. The heroes of the faith, the prophets, the psalmist, often speak of crying. And Paul, too, said he served the Lord, quote, with many tears. There is nothing wrong with weeping." End of quote. Let me give you the ultimate illustration. Jesus wept. That ought to seal that one. John 11:35. I have a third suggestion. 1, just recognize up front, people can be mean, even friends. 2, When it's appropriate, when you feel like it, go have a good cry. Number three, and I think this is the lesson from this huge hunk of scripture. Stand your ground. He was innocent. He was not guilty of anything, and he just gave it back to them. So I think the appropriate phrase in light of today's culture is stand your ground. Now let me talk about that for a minute. Matter of fact, for many years there was laws in the United States called the Castle Doctrine. You ever heard of the Castle Doctrine? It's been around a long time. That's a series of laws that says that when a person is protecting his home, his castle, he can use deadly force in self-defense when his or her property or home is being invaded. More than half of the states have some form, right now, of a castle doctrine. If somebody breaks in your house, you can defend yourself even with deadly force, and you will not be accused of a crime if you shoot the person. By the way, I'm not advocating physical violence. I'm just trying to illustrate something. So that has morphed into a new law, and we know about it because of what's happened in Florida. It's called the Stand Your Ground Law. And it's a little broader than the Castle Doctrine. The Stand Your Ground Law states that when a person may use deadly force in self-defense without the duty of retreat when faced with a reasonable perceived threat. Now, please hear me. I'm not talking about physical violence. I'm talking about the principle of there are times when you need to stand your ground. And Job is a perfect illustration of that. He could have, really suffered some severe psychological damage if he'd have listened to them. But what I liked about this was, if I understand this law correctly, it says, without the duty of retreat. It's not your duty to retreat if you're right. It's not your duty to retreat if you're innocent and they're accusing you of being guilty. So, to use the popular phrase today, in the proper sense of the term, stand your ground. When you're right and a friend is being mean, stand your ground. You do not have to retreat. Amen. 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 Father, thank you for giving us this example. Thank you for teaching us through your word that we need to be gentle, but we need to stand. Give us both of those characteristics, I pray. In Jesus' name, amen.